Hi, and welcome to the Mallory Nye Writer and Academic podcast series. This is episode 9. This episode has been a difficult one to prepare. As you'll see, it's quite long, so grab a cup of tea or coffee or something and get ready for a lengthy discussion. It started when I was preparing a different podcast episode, one for the Religion Bites series. My most recent topic in that series has been on the theme of religion and race. I had it all ready to record, but as I sat down to do so on the morning of Thursday the 18th of June, I found myself quickly checking Facebook and Twitter. For some reason, I hadn't yet listened to the radio news, and so this was the first I heard of the unspeakable shootings at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church on Calhoun Street, Charleston. It stopped me in my tracks. I found myself unable to record that episode on race and religion for much of the following week. Where would I start with this now? How could I condense the issues of whiteness and race into a short discussion of theory? And so, I found myself preparing this podcast instead, for my Mallory Nye Writer and Academic podcast series. Here, I can talk more specifically about the Charleston shootings on the 17th of June, and reflect on the many issues and concerns that have emerged from this brutal act of racial violence. I've read a lot about the issue over the past 2 weeks. There has been an outpouring of views and comments on the many issues around the shootings, the history of racist violence, of white supremacy and white privilege. I think there are many people who are struggling, like me, to make sense of the incomprehensible, of how a country has avoided living with its shameful past. As I say this, though, I don't wish this to be seen as an outsider's indictment. A throwing of criticism across the Atlantic from some privileged British viewpoint. I write with my own discomfort and shame about the history of slavery in North America, the legacy of a system of brutal inequality, of subhuman treatment of forced labourers that the British themselves established. The critiques of US southern white privilege are equally critiques of British imperialism that have as yet gone largely unacknowledged in the UK. As I briefly alluded to in my last episode on Henry Dundas. The killings in Charleston on the 17th of June open up a lot of issues that travel a long way around the world. And so to try to make some sense of this for myself and hopefully for others, I have clustered my reflections, my thinking about this, into different areas. First, I will talk about the history behind the church and the violence, the long history of violence, that we are continuing to live within. That takes us squarely into the issue of white supremacy and particular extremist and moderate versions of this ideology. From there, I will raise the question of terrorism, the fact that of all the words to use, this is probably the most powerful. And finally, I will say a few words about gun controls and the urgent need for the impossible to happen in the United States. On Wednesday the 17th of June, 2015, a young white male went into the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Calhoun Street, Charleston. Reports say that he sat for a short while, then took out a gun and shot 9 people dead, 6 women and 3 men. He left a further person seriously injured. The people who died were as follows: Cynthia Hurd, Clementa Pinckney, Sharonda Coleman Singleton, Tywanza Sanders, Ethel Lance, DePayne Middleton Doctor, Susie Jackson, and Daniel Simmons Sr. Neither the time or the place of this act of political violence were randomly chosen. The AME Church is the oldest black African-American church in the US south of Baltimore. It dates back to 1816 and has been attacked, at times destroyed, by hostile white groups, including the local government, on several occasions. It was associated with the attempt by Denmark Vesey to organize a slave revolt and lead African-American slaves in Charleston to freedom. The date of that planned revolt would have been the early morning of the 17th of June, 1822. It is probably correct to say that America, in the wake of these 2015 killings, will not be the same. Or at least the hope is that the deaths will enable the USA to find a better way of living with its difficult past and its contemporary tensions. I'm not going to say anything in particular about the person who is believed to have done the shootings, a young white male who was caught on the 18th of June, and who has been associated with a white supremacist website. I have no interest in naming this individual. The people who should be remembered are those who died, not their killer. There is no indication yet that this man was part of any activist or terrorist cell. From the website that's been found, he appears to have had affiliations with certain white supremacist groups and similar wider influences. But his actions appear at present to have sprung from his own decision rather than anything more organized. Even so, these actions did not come from nowhere. They came out of a long history of violence by white supremacists against black individuals and communities in the southern USA. There were over 2.5 centuries of institutionalized slavery in the region, an economic system based on the forced, brutal exploitation of men and women held in captivity for their labor. The violence of this system and the violence required to make this system intact led eventually to the horrors of the American Civil War. Following the defeat of the Confederate States in 1865, the Reconstruction led eventually to the system of Jim Crow, of racial segregation and severe economic disadvantage of black communities vis-à-vis the whites. On top of this, political control was maintained by fear and violence. Ad hoc lynchings, non-judicial executions of individuals occurred on a regular basis. A recent 2013 study by the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, has put a figure of 3,959 black people who were killed in racial terror lynchings in a dozen southern states between 1877 and 1950. To quote this report, "Lynchings were violent and public acts of torture that traumatized black people throughout the country and were largely tolerated by state and federal officials. These lynchings were terrorism. Terror lynchings peaked between 1880 and 1940 and claimed the lives of African-American men, women, and children who were forced to endure the fear, humiliation, and barbarity of this widespread phenomenon unaided." These killings were often motivated by specific political ends, as assassinations against potential political leaders, or to frighten blacks from voting. In some cases, they were self-serving mob justice on perceived attacks by blacks on the white community, very often related to perceived threats by black males against white females. In some cases, they were lynchings of black women, including pregnant black women. There are stories of such murdered women having the babies ripped from their wombs and then stamped on by the crowds. Very often, lynches were directed at individuals seeking fairness, equality, and civil rights. The EJI report lists the following examples of lynchings. In 1940, Jesse Thornton was lynched in Laverne, Alabama, for referring to a white police officer by his name without the title of Mr. White men lynched Jeff Brown in 1916 in Cedar Bluff, Mississippi, for accidentally bumping into a white girl as he ran to catch a train. In 1918, when Elton Mitchell of Earle, Arkansas, refused to work on a white-owned farm without pay, prominent white citizens of the city cut him into pieces with butcher's knives and hung his remains from a tree. In Hernando, Mississippi, in 1935, when white landowners learned that Reverend T.A. Allen was trying to start a sharecroppers' union among local impoverished and exploited black laborers, they formed a mob, seized him, shot him many times, and threw him into the Coldwater River. These all happened in the era after the end of slavery.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rock, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter cry.
There were also attacks specifically against black churches. Most famously, of course, the Ku Klux Klan's bombing of 16th Street Church in Birmingham, Alabama, on the 15th of September 1963, in which four young girls were killed. According to Connor Friedersdorf in The Atlantic, black churches suffered at the hands of thugs and terrorists throughout the civil rights era, as they had for a century before. But such attacks aren't a matter of remote history. As recently as the 1990s, a wave of firebombings hit black churches. Congressional hearings were held in 1996 at the end of a two-year period when such arson spiked across the Southeast. In South Carolina alone, black churches that suffered probable arson attacks included Mount Zion AME Church in Williamsburg, Macedonia Baptist Church in Manning, St. Paul Baptist Church in Lexington, Rosemary Baptist Church in Barnwell, St. John Baptist Church in Dixiana, Effington Baptist Church, Mount Olivet Baptist Church, and Allen's Chapel. One member of Congress likened firebombings in those years to the return of a biblical plague. The most recent burning of a black church to make national headlines occurred in Massachusetts the day Barack Obama was inaugurated as the first black president. A white man was later convicted in what prosecutors called a racially motivated arson attack. Indeed, the Charleston shooting was at least the 91st violent attack on a black church since 1956. And furthermore, in the days following the AME church attacks, there were a further 9 reported cases of arson attacks against black churches in the South. The civil rights movement of the 1960s did lead to immense improvements, but still, in 2015, there are clearly ongoing problems. The deaths of young black males by police officers in Ferguson, Baltimore, New York, and elsewhere in the past year have raised the temperature immensely. There is not as yet any clear evidence that any of these were purposefully racist attacks, in the way that we appear to have evidence that the AME shootings were. But each of them are highly significant in their own right, and underline the need for a fundamental recognition of hardline attitudes of institutional racism in the police force. As Ta-Nehisi Coates has commented about his native Baltimore, "Everyone I knew who lived in that world regarded the police not with admiration and respect, but with fear and caution." And the story he goes on to tell about the young Freddie Gray, who died in police custody in Baltimore in April 2015, is shocking. It's worth remembering what specifically happened to Freddie Gray. An officer made eye contact with Gray. Gray, for unknown reasons, ran. The officer and his colleagues then detained Gray. They found him in possession of a switchblade. They arrested him while he yelled in pain. And then, within an hour, his spine was mostly severed. A week later, he was dead. What specifically was the crime here? What particular threat did Freddie Gray pose? Why is mere eye contact and then running worthy of detention at the hands of the state? Why is Freddie Gray dead? Following the public outcry against this incident, the Maryland District Attorney, Marilyn J. Mosby, announced that charges of homicide would be brought against the officers involved in Gray's death. Yet more recently, we have the case of the Texas police response to complaints from white neighbors to a pool party organized by black youngsters in McKinney in Texas. A video clip recorded on someone's phone went viral in its showing of an officer dragging a 15-year-old girl wearing only a bikini to the ground and restraining her, and then pulling his gun to assert authority over the girl's friends when they protested. In this case, the officer was suspended in advance of an investigation, and no long-term physical harm resulted. As an indication of long-standing concerns about the violations of civil liberties by the police, and particularly those directed against the black community, the American Council of Civil Liberties, ACLU, in various US states, have developed and distributed phone apps through Google Play to protect citizens from such brutality. The apps not only educate the phone user about their civil rights, particularly helpful in an emergency, it also allows them to film an incident without it being evident on the phone screen that they are doing so. The phone also immediately uploads the video to the ACLU server, so that the phone's evidence cannot be seized and destroyed by the officers. All this has been developed on a legal basis, and to enable citizens to take actions that are within the law. There is an ongoing problem. Everyone seems to know about it, but there is little public acknowledgement. Well, there is plenty of public acknowledgement, but few people, particularly those in power, seem to be listening to it. The problem goes on and on, seemingly getting worse and worse. The African Americans find themselves with power frequently mobilized against them as a community by a powerful white national establishment. As the Reverend Broderick Greer argues, there is nothing isolated about the violence enacted upon black people by law enforcement officers, vigilantes, or terrorists. When police officers or extrajudicial neighborhood watchmen shoot dead descendants of this nation's formerly enslaved population, they are recommitting themselves to the white American tradition of squashing out black life at every juncture possible. But to deny the interconnectedness of white American terrorism and violence perpetrated on the bodies of black people is to linearize and domesticate time, and to ignore the oceanic, circular nature of history, a history that assures us that some cable news pundits will more readily humanize the killer than his black victims, like the Reverend Clementa C. Pinckney, Mother Emanuel's pastor, and a South Carolina state senator. And this quote brings us directly to the Emanuel AME Church itself, and its own history of violence. As I've said already, it was first established in 1816 as a church encouraged by the AME, the Mother Church in Baltimore. It was the first such church in the American South at a time when slavery was a large part of the Southern culture and society. Indeed, I will leave it for Reverend Pinckney himself to say something about this, as we have a recording of him talking about his church in 2013, which can be found on YouTube if you follow the link on the show notes.
My name is Reverend Clemente Pinckney, and as of a couple of weeks ago, I'm in my fourth year of pastoring here at the church, and along with pastoring here at Mother Emanuel, since the year 2000, it's been my privilege to serve the people in South Carolina Senate District 45 in the state legislature. Where you are is a very special place in Charleston, and it's a very special place because this church and this site, this area, has been tied to the history and life of African Americans since about the early 1800s. This church was built in 1891. The congregation was formed in 1818 by the Reverend Morris Brown, who later became the second bishop of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And for those of you who may know a little something about our denomination, we started in 1787 through our founder, Richard Allen, who left then St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church because they were telling him he needed to pray after the regular members prayed. And so that's how the denomination began, in a fit of civil disobedience and a little issue with theological fairness, if you will. So with that backdrop, it's only fitting that we invited you here. What our church and denomination stands for is really, it stands for the universal vision of all people being treated fairly under the law as God sees us in his sight. And so we welcome you here today. Just a little story about our church and how it really ties into the life of African Americans in South Carolina and also a little bit in the nation. I mentioned to you earlier that the founder of our church, his name was Morris Brown, who later became the second leader of our denomination, founded this church in what was actually a three-part circuit in the African-American community outside of the city of Charleston. The street right in front of the church is called Calhoun Street, but several hundred years ago, it wasn't Calhoun Street. It was called Boundary Street, which meant that's where the city boundaries were. And outside of the city boundaries, out in the country or the suburbs, is where most of the African Americans in the greater Charleston area resided. In particular, those who were free, those who had gained their freedom, the majority of them stayed outside of the Charleston area. And so there were churches in and around the area, and in particular three, and then later became one church. In about 1822, there was an interesting minister here in the church whose name was Denmark Vesey. And Denmark Vesey planned an insurrection. And it was planned, the rebellion was planned so well that once the authorities found out about it, they had a little Guantanamo experiment. They basically took Denmark Vesey and all of the co-conspirators that they could find, and they interrogated them. And they, for years, did not really reveal the plan because they were afraid that someone else would pick it up and actually put it into practice. And that was from a minister who was here at the church. From the Denmark Vesey incident, the state of South Carolina really, really got concerned and scared. And so we have the military College of South Carolina. Does anybody know what that is? The Military College of South Carolina? The Citadel. Does anyone know where the original site of the Citadel was? You actually passed it on Meeting Street. The old Embassy Suites Hotel is the old Citadel. the guns of the Citadel were basically facing this site and the community of Africans, African Americans, who were living in this area. And that's how the Citadel got started. It was later on that the state of South Carolina, because of the work of black congregations in Charleston, to include Emmanuel, who were teaching persons to read and really, in a sense, sort of fomenting this desire that all people should be free in the state, basically put out a law or instituted a law that closed Emmanuel. I mean, by state law, the church was closed along with others. And it was about 40 years until the church was reestablished. And so that year that it was reestablished was the end of the Civil War. And so the history of our church and African Americans and Africans, as we were known in those days, in Charleston, has a significant tie. And it was in 1863 when the Civil War was really turning, and right after the Emancipation Proclamation was introduced and decreed, that missionaries from Baltimore actually came down, reestablished the church, along with setting up other churches across the area.
There is no doubt that the shootings were not simply the act of a madman. It doesn't matter whether or not the killer was mad, insane, mentally ill, or deluded. His actions came from a wider pool of ideas. He emerged, if we can use the metaphor, from the swamp of white supremacy. And this swamp covers a very wide area and goes very deep. Evidence seems to be emerging of his connections with some far-right supremacist groups, in particular the Council of Concerned Citizens. It appears to be a similar story to the killings in Isla Vista in May 2014. A person spends a lot of time on the internet reading hate comments about gender or race or both, and then goes out on a killing spree targeted against people who represent this hatred to him. It doesn't matter that not everybody who gets involved in these hate groups do actually go out and commit mass murder. It only takes one person with a gun to cause so much death. The story also has resonances with the killings in Norway in July 2011, when a white supremacist launched his own crusade against what he saw as the dangers of the Islamicization of Europe. He wrote a manifesto, in this case over 1,000 pages long, and posted it to the internet with pictures of himself ready for combat. In the case of the Norway attacks, however, they were targeted at the ruling groups of society, who the killer felt were not taking seriously enough the threats to white supremacy. He planted a bomb next to a government building in Oslo, and then went on a shooting rampage at a political youth camp on the island of Utøya, killing 69 young people, teenagers and young adults, and seriously injuring many more. The message of the Norway killings was quite like that in Charleston, based on a self-identified chivalric white power that is somehow indigenous to the land, and which is being threatened by intolerant, uncivilized invaders. In Norway, and for neo-Nazis of much of Europe, this threat is focused on Muslims, particularly those who are descended from North American migrants. In Charleston, the focus is more particularly on the black African communities, descendants of the slaves brought from Africa by the European settlers. In both cases, the use of mass killings has been to make a very strong political point of terror. Much of the focus of the discussion after the deaths in Charleston arose around the issue of the Confederate flag and all that it represents in southern USA. Ta-Nehisi Coates, again, raised it prominently in a piece in The Atlantic magazine on Thursday the 18th of June, the day after the shootings. The piece was titled, "Take Down the Confederate Flag Now." The problem was that the South Carolina government had placed the flag next to the state capitol building on the basis of it being part of the Southern heritage. As I record this episode, the flag is still there, although there is now talk of the state government voting to take the flag down. As Coates argued, the Confederate flag's defenders often claim it represents heritage, not hatred. I agree, Coates argues. The heritage of white supremacy was not so much birthed by hate as by the impulse towards plunder. The Charleston church killer plundered 9 different bodies last night, plundered 9 different families of an original member, plundered 9 different communities of a singular member. An entire people are poorer for his action. The flag that he embraced, which many South Carolinians embrace, does not stand in opposition to this act, it endorses it. That the Confederate flag is the symbol of white supremacists is evidenced by the very words of those who birthed it. In the 1861 Cornerstone speech at the establishment of the Confederation, it was said, "Our new government is founded. Its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth." End of quote. This clear identification between Confederacy, historical racism, and white supremacy, and the symbol of that government, the battle flag, has been at the centre of the campaign against the flag that swept America in the week after the shootings. It was as though people had suddenly taken another look at what was ever present, an ongoing representation of a hateful set of memories. The simple question was asked, can this Confederate flag be a neutral symbol of heritage and identity, when it was clearly used in 2 periods to represent white supremacy and black suppression? That is, during the Civil War, when it was the battle flag of the white supremacist slavery confederation, and then a century later, during the civil rights movement of the 1960s, when it represented resistance by whites to the sharing of power with blacks. Slow movements have been made in this debate. It has become harder to brush the issue under the carpet. But for both critics and supporters of the Confederate flag, its symbolism is still an important living part of American life in many parts of the USA. It has also been pointed out that the symbolism does not only amount to a flag. There are many reminders, one could say celebrations, of Southern American states' white supremacism. A small example of this is the very street on which the AME Church is sited in Charleston, named Calhoun Street. John Calhoun was a slave owner in South Carolina, who served as a U.S. vice president and later as senator for the state, and was a very activist pro-slavery official. He pushed for the expansion of slavery in the U.S.'s new territories, as well as helping to establish the Federal Fugitive Slave Act, which required all states, including non-slavery states, to actively return runaway slaves to their owners. His place in South Carolinian history is honored by his name on the street and a statue of him high on a plinth in nearby Marion Square. In May 2014, when a young man went on a killing spree with a gun in the town of Isla Vista in California, there was considerable discussion of the realization that such crimes could be viewed as a form of terrorism. The scholar Mark Eugensmeyer, who happened to live in the area where the shootings happened, published a post on his blog soon after the deaths in which he named the actions as terrorism. Very soon, this spread far beyond Eugensmeyer's own argument, saying that the killings were a form of misogynist terrorism. It is no surprise, then, that the Charleston killings very soon began to be discussed using the term racial terrorism. Indeed, this isn't much of a surprise. It's not a particularly new idea after all. The Equal Justice Initiative report on lynchings quoted already described them as terrorist actions. And, On a lighter, more popular cultural note, the Black Eyed Peas' 2003 song, Where Is the Love, penned by will.i.am and other members of the group, and also Justin Timberlake, take a similar view. The first verse of the song makes a very clear statement about the issue of terrorism being not only about the overseas war on terror, but in fact also relates to white supremacists, the KKK. Thus, will.i.am sings the following lyrics.
Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate, and to discriminate only generates hate, and when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness is what you demonstrate, and that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love just to set it straight, take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love, y'all, y'all.
People killing, people dying, children hurt and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach, and would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us, send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning, where is the love?
For me, the point is that if we are going to use the term terrorism, and of course it is used very frequently, then we have to recognise its limitations and perhaps the underlying currents of what that terminology is saying. What is gained by calling it terrorism? It puts the unspeakable act into a language that can be understood. It's not a particularly precise language, but it does give us a handle to try and understand what is happening. At one level, terrorism appears to describe political violence, distinguishing politically orientated violence from individual criminality. Terrorist acts come from a particular place, a distinct group, no matter how loosely they are organized, and are aimed at particular targets. Terrorism is, then, an act of violence linked to social tensions and perpetrated with the apparent aim of escalating those tensions. The problem seems to be when the people using the political violence are seemingly similar to us. That is, terrorism is very often ethnically and religiously charged. The terror is other from us, being either Arab or South Asian and or being Muslim. Is it possible for white Christian Americans to recognize the terrorism of a fellow white Christian American? The Charleston killings were certainly political violence. Violence by a white supremacy extremist aimed at those who he saw as his enemies. It most probably had a political aim and came from a wider social movement than simply him being a lone wolf or a crazy individual. In many ways, the purpose of calling it terrorism is to make sure the extremism of the views are taken seriously. For some, the use of terrorism is to draw attention to the redundancy or overuse of the term in American popular discourse. For those who have listened to the Black Eyed Peas, we have known about such white terrorism for years, that the world is full of such political violence. It is not only the preserve of the militant Islamists who have dominated American media, but underlying this still deeper is the unspoken fear of the internal conflict within America, the lingering memories of the American Civil War, that white supremacism is a force powerful enough to disrupt, that is, to tear apart, the fabric of the society and the nation. What do Americans do when the terrorist is one of us, or is so like us that we hate him all the more for it, when he does things we would not dream of doing, but does so in our name and on our behalf? On a slightly lighter level, it was interesting to see the comments of the American comedian Jon Stewart on his show the day after the shootings. Instead of trying to find a humorous side to the bleak news, he delivered a powerful homily on the weaknesses he saw in American discourses about such events. His comments cut deep, right up to the bone, and made a lasting impression. He said, "I have nothing other than just sadness that once again we have to peer into the abyss of the depraved violence that we do to each other, and the nexus of a just gaping racial wound that will not heal, but we pretend doesn't exist. I'm confident, though, that by acknowledging it, by staring into that and seeing it for what it is, we still won't do jack shit. Yeah, that's us. The whole idea of how to account for the motivations and causes of the shootings led him to criticize the slowness of the media to acknowledge the culture that made such violence possible. He said, "I heard someone on the news say, 'A tragedy has visited this church.' This wasn't a tornado. This was racist. This was a guy with a Rhodesian badge on his sweater. This one is black and white. There's no nuance here. And we're going to keep pretending. I don't get it. What happened? There's one guy lost his mind." We are steeped in that culture in this country, and we refuse to recognize it. And I cannot believe how hard people are working to discount it. Stuart pointed to what he called the racial wallpaper of South Carolina. The Confederate flag flies over South Carolina, and the roads are named for Confederate generals. And the white guy's the one who feels like his country's been taken away from him. I'd also like to add here a few comments about the issue of gun control in the USA. As an outsider to the country, there is a chilling, nasty inevitability about news of gun crimes, and particularly mass shoot-ups. It simply happens so much. As President Obama commented quickly in the wake of the Charleston shootings on the 18th of June, "At some point, we as a country will have to reckon with the fact that this type of mass violence does not happen in other advanced countries." He added to this the following day by pointing out that more than 11,000 Americans were killed by gun violence in 2013 alone. There seems to be no end of examples to point to. Columbine, Virginia Tech, Fort Hood, the shooting of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords in Tucson, Arizona, the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, the primary school in Newtown, Connecticut, and the sorority attacks in Isla Vista, California. Not all gun killings are from legally owned firearms, but too many such deaths are. In the UK, here in Scotland, we still recall the shootings at the Dunblane Primary School in 1996, when 16 young children and their teachers lost their lives. The response to this by the government was decisive. Within less than 2 years, a nationwide ban on most forms of gun ownership was introduced by the UK government. This has undoubtedly helped to reduce the public risk. Determined individuals can cause harm in many different ways, with or without guns. But the casual option of gun violence is thwarted if there is no easily available gun in the glove box or sideboard. In short, guns do kill people. They are a tool with the power to do immense damage. People fire them, and the guns have no agency of their own. They give people agency to cause death. In the wrong hands, they are literally lethal. The point is, we should do whatever we can to prevent them being put in the wrong hands. Much of the US debate about gun control, of the current liberal gun ownership laws, has centred on the opinions of the US founding fathers, in particular the existence of the 1791 Second Amendment to the Constitution. The wording of this is, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." There are problems in trying to implement this amendment in the present day. After all, it was over 200 years ago, at a time with a much smaller population and firearms technology that was quite different from today. The interpretation of this amendment also seems to be key, whether it refers to guns being linked to a militia or to individuals, a matter which the Supreme Court has been debating for years. And third, political vested interests can be wrong. Just because it would be near impossible to repeal or revise the amendment does not mean it should not be attempted. A recent piece in The Atlantic, again, has been useful in this respect, pointing out that gun control could be more effective, even taking into account the sacredness of the Second Amendment, since there are things the federal government could do if it took the opportunity that would make firearms, or the proliferation of firearms, a little safer, without necessarily interfering with the public's right to bear arms. Three things in particular would help. First, better vetting of rogue gun suppliers. It's reported that 1% of suppliers are responsible for selling the majority of firearms used in gun-related crimes. At present, it's not legally possible to trace a gun back to the seller. Secondly, a tightening of the requirements on sellers to check eligibility for gun purchases. The ID checks required for liquor purchases are very strict, but gun checks are at the opposite end of the spectrum. There is a disparity that needs to be addressed. And third, in a similar way to cars, compulsory insurance for gun owners. Many gun injuries are not covered by normal health insurance. Good or responsible gun ownership could be rewarded by lower premiums. The price of a gun attack is more than the physical damage it causes. Such compulsory insurance would not violate the right to bear arms. It would simply place that right within the responsibility of such ownership to the owner and to the wider society. It's often said that such progressive changes will not and could not happen. Obama's view is something has to happen. His weariness at the cost of mass gun killings is evident, and this must create action at some point. The 19th century anti-slavery campaigner Theodore Parker wrote that the American people should never give up on making changes, even if the Founding Fathers set out their views in the Constitution. It was Parker who coined the term government of the people, by the people, and for the people, that of course President Abraham Lincoln later took up and made his own in the Gettysburg Address. This is the principle behind it, by the people and for the people. The substance of the country's constitution is not solely what the Supreme Court judges consider to be the interpretation of the Founding Fathers' opinions. It is what the people today choose. It may possibly be the case that at present the American people are happy with such liberal gun laws, but this might not always be the case. One day they may wish to see that change. To wrap up this long discussion, I want to return to the issue of white supremacism and white privilege, one of the deepest and most challenging issues of the event. The actions of the killer brought to my mind some comments made by Ta-Nehisi Coates around a year ago by another overt racist. This related to a rancher in Nevada called Cliven Bundy, who commented to the media that he thought African Americans might have been better off as cotton-picking slaves than they are at present. In commenting on this, Coates drew our attention away from the stupidity of the argument, are they better off or not, to the discomfort that such an overt racist causes with their brutal statements. He said, "The problem with Cliven Bundy isn't that he is a racist, but that he's an oafish racist. He invokes the crudest stereotypes, like cotton picking. This makes white people feel bad. The elegant racist knows how to injure non-white people while never summoning the spectre of white guilt. Elegant racism is invisible, supple, and enduring. It disguises itself in the national vocabulary, avoids epithets and didacticism. Grace is the singular marker of elegant racism. Shooting a group of people in a church is not elegant. It is not in the interests of elegant racism, the invisible and hidden in plain sight white supremacy that divides America. As I have noted in the ensuing discussion about flags, many people have rushed to defend Southern history and symbols such as the flag, and point out it is not all about such killings, slavery, and lynchings. You don't have to like the brutality of that history to be a white supremacist, or indeed to enjoy the privileges of whiteness. Indeed, for most of white America, that is the past and should remain there. Full stop. But it is an unexamined and unacknowledged past that has not necessarily been transcended as much as some would think or like. For the majority of black Americans, the myths of equality and American democracy have yet to be fulfilled. Quite simply, the attack on the Charleston AME Church has reminded people, for a short time, of a division, of a festering wound, the gaping racial wound that will not heal, but we pretend doesn't exist. Racial tensions in America and the brutal politics of white supremacy didn't disappear with Martin Luther King's campaign of change, nor did they become resolved by the election of President Barack Obama. Ta-Nehisi Coates has summarized this well in his major article in The Atlantic last summer, titled The Case for Reparations, an Intellectual Autopsy. He argued, having been enslaved for 250 years, black people were not left to their own devices. They were terrorized. In the Deep South, a second slavery ruled. In the North, legislatures, mayors, civic associations, banks, and citizens all colluded to pin black people into ghettos, where they were overcrowded, overcharged, and undereducated. Businesses discriminated against them, awarding them the worst jobs and the worst wages. Police brutalized them in the streets. And the notion that black lives, black bodies, and black wealth were rightful targets remained deeply rooted in the broader society. Now we have half stepped away from our long centuries of despoilment, promising never again, but still we are haunted. He has summed the legacy of slavery up very succinctly and graphically. It is as though we have run up a credit card bill, and having pledged to charge no more, remained befuddled that the balance doesn't disappear. The effects of that balance, interest accruing daily, are all around us. In many respects, the discussion of this historically perpetuated injustice has only just begun, and there is not yet in sight any start on the discussion of how it could ever be addressed. To finish off this lengthy podcast, I will let the words of Clementa Pinckney conclude this discussion. As noted already, Senator Pinckney was the pastor of the African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston and was one of the 9 people who died at the hands of the white supremacist gunman. This is the recording again from YouTube when he gave a short speech to a group of students on a visit to his church in 2013. And of course, thanks for listening to this podcast. I hope you gained something from it if you persevered this far. Bye for now.
In a nutshell, you can say that the African American church, and in particular in South Carolina, really has seen it as its responsibility and its ministry and its calling to be fully integrated and caring about the lives of its constituents and the general community. We don't see ourselves, or many of us don't see ourselves, as just a place where we come and worship, but as a beacon and as a bearer of the culture and a bearer of what makes us a people. But I like to say that this is not necessarily unique to us. It's really what America is all about. Could we not argue that America is about freedom, whether we live it out or not? But it really is about freedom, equality, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's what churches are all about. Freedom to worship and freedom from sin, freedom to be full what God intends us to be, and to have equality in the sight of God. And sometimes, You got to make noise to do that. Sometimes you may have to die like Denmark Vesey to do that. Sometimes you have to march and struggle and be unpopular to do that. And so I just wanted to share that about the church, and also to say that along with Commissioner Washington, we're both ministers who are involved in public policy and involved in lawmaking. And there are many people who say, why would you as a preacher, why would you as a pastor be involved in public life? And I've already said it, but I'll say it again. Our calling is not just within the walls of the congregation, but we are part of the life and community in which our congregation resides. And so many have made great strides, and we've encouraged others to do so. And even now, we don't like to see our church as a museum, but as still a place of change and still a place where we can hopefully change and work on the hearts and minds and spirits of all people. And we hope that you will find a kindred spirit here at Mother Emmanuel. And we hope that while you're in the holy city, hopefully you'll find some fish somewhere tonight and some shrimp, and that you will just really enjoy yourselves.